This evening, we are considering God's grace at work amongst First Nations people up and down the West Coast. We are living in difficult days in ministering to First Nations people. There has been a history of harm, a history of retreat, and right now it almost seems racist to try and convert a person who is of First Nations in this country to the gospel and to live a godly life. And we pray that God will have mercy again upon the peoples of this country who call this their native home. Now, as we think tonight of Thomas Crosby, who is the focus of the missionary work on the West Coast, I want to begin with a timeline of dates, because really the history here in British Columbia is all relatively new. When this Bible was published back in 1611, did anybody know about the west coast of British Columbia and up into Alaska? When the Westminster Confession was being written in London, England, did anyone know that these peoples were even alive and would also need the gospel? In 1777, Captain Cook explored the West Coast, and it was on his third major and final voyage. And some attribute the outbreak of smallpox to the visit of Captain Cook to the West Coast. Some historians will point out, and archaeologists as well, will point out that up to 90 or 95% of the population died in the smallpox epidemic on this West Coast. As Europeans arrived on the East, that disease traveled across the country through the prairies and just time and time again. But it is believed that it was brought by ship to this coast, and with any mingling with the people, they contracted that disease. In 1792, that was the year Captain Vancouver charted the waters of British Columbia right up and down the coast to Alaska. And it was referred to as the greatest marine survey ever completed. Then in 1827 was the establishment of Fort Langley, and that is considered the birthplace of British Columbia. And of course, the settlement of Hudson Bay and the beginning of fur trading, which preceded the gold rush about 50 years. And then in 1858, there was the founding of New Westminster. And that was right at the time of the beginning of the gold rush. I want to read to you a little snippet that I found. In 1858, news was spreading of rich gold deposits in British Columbia's Caribou country. In their scramble to strike it rich, many prospectors stopped for provisions at Fort Victoria. The sleepy trading post exploded from a population of about 300 to over 5,000 in less than a year, and by 1862, Victoria was a bustling little city. Then in 1885 was the year of the last spike of the railroad, and that was really when British Columbia became a place of great interest, tourists, travelers, people going on the ocean by ship would travel by rail, and British Columbia really came into its own. And then 1886 was the year of the Great Fire in Vancouver, and we spoke about when Jonathan Goforth and his wife were passing through on their way to China, that they just found a charred remains of a city at that time. 1866 was when Victoria became the capital city of British Columbia. It was supposed to be New Westminster, but then it was switched to Victoria, and there was no shortage of malcontent about that. It seemed a great loss to the mainland when Victoria was chosen to be the place of the capital of the province. 1871, British Columbia joined the Confederation and became part of federal Canada. Now, most of the First Nations people lived among the coastline at river mouths and flat areas and on islands. They depended mainly on hunting and fishing, and while they had some complex traditions, they had no written texts, and this is one of the difficulties about learning of the ancient traditions of the First Nations people. There are no libraries, no journals, no holy books. Everything was by oral tradition. Life for First Nations people in those years was exceedingly difficult. Life expectancy was low. They were living in a very wet climate, a place where pneumonia and various diseases was transmitted, and I'm sure amongst children the mortality rate was very high. I want to lead you right up the coast now to almost the border with Alaska, about 40 miles north of Prince Rupert, where there was a fort established called Fort Simpson. Now, sometimes it's referred to as Port Simpson, and other times as Fort Simpson. The First Nations people there were known as Simpsheans. Now, there is no relation between Simpson and Simpsheans. They sound similar in some ways, but that fort was called after a British governor, Simpson, but the First Nations people, their name was Simpsheans. And of course, they began to trade with Hudson Bay, who had established a fur trading fort right there at the mouth of that river. And there was great interaction around that fort, and it is believed around 3,000 people were living and interacting and trading with that particular place. First Nations people lived in long houses. They did not have private dwellings. They had long houses which were halfway dugouts covered with lumber and various means of keeping out the weather. They had a fire pit in the middle, and maybe 50 people would live and sleep in that area, and they would all sleep in a circle with their feet pointing toward the fire. You know how it is. If your feet are warm, you can sleep anywhere. And that is how they lived. You can understand that in those living conditions, that when some infectious disease was contracted, that it spread through the whole population very rapidly. A British naval officer who was in and out of that port and learning the ways of the First Nations, their wildness, their misery, he pleaded with the Anglican Church to send a missionary. And a man called the Reverend Duncan went to Fort Simpson and established a mission, was there about 5 years, and then he moved from the area and he took with him 50 converts to a particular island called Metlakatla, right in the same area, just a few miles away. But at that time, Fort Simpson was wide open for missionary work. And it was not long until Thomas Crosby was sent there, not by the Anglicans, but by the Methodist Church, to commence mission work amongst the natives of Fort Simpson, the Simpsheans. Now, Thomas Crosby's family were English. His father had come from England, from Yorkshire, little town called Pickering, and they were Wesleyan Methodists. And they arrived in Ontario, set up home in Woodstock, Ontario, where Thomas was born, grew up as a young man, and of course within the Methodist Church heard the gospel, was converted. But because he grew up rather poor, he didn't get a lot of education, and although he was zealous to serve the Lord, there was no open door for him to serve in the church. And so it wasn't long until he responded to advertisements and various appeals to become a missionary to the West Coast. In 1861, he arrived here in British Columbia. And in 1863, at the age of 23, he was sent to teach the First Nations people in Nanaimo, B.C. And in 1866, he became an itinerant preacher in these parts with another man called Reverend Edward White. And he was on a circuit covering Vancouver Island, the Gulf Islands, and the area of Vancouver. In 1869, Crosby was appointed to a stable position in Chilliwack, where there was a Methodist mission, and it was their, seemingly their district headquarters, if you will. And so it was a prestigious position, a place where he was learning and gaining experience in the Lord's work. Now, Christian work was greatly needed in Victoria due to the large number of First Nations people who came up and down the coast and trading in Victoria. And at this time, the Haidas and the Tsimsheans who visited Victoria, they fell into the liquor trade, or they became victims of the liquor trade. And it became an exceeding great problem amongst these First Nations people. An eyewitness to these events in those early days describes it in this way. Now, I want to give you his words, not mine. I want you to hear from an eyewitness what alcohol was doing to the First Nations people at that time. He says, a First Nation's love of strong drink is so keen that he will sell his wife or his children into worse than slavery to obtain money to buy it. No sacrifice is too great, no price too high to gratify his appetite for the inebriating bowl. Several so-called importing wholesale liquor establishments were the headquarters, the manufactories, where most of the vile liquid was made and sold by the bottle, or Higgins, the passing of a race. I don't understand what those words mean. I couldn't get to the bottom of that statement. And it's probably one of the slang words for alcohol and maybe a brand of alcohol. Nevertheless, the effects upon the local population was absolutely ruinous. To the morals, to peace and life, it caused carnage, fighting, and death. In 1828, the Hudson Bay Company banned the sale of liquor. They obviously recognized its damage, what it was doing to the people, but it was the miners who perpetuated the sale of alcohol. And of course, miners who moved in, they were seeking women, they were seeking immoral lives, and they were willing to trade alcohol for women. And it was a ruinous, disastrous situation. Let me read you another quote. The traffic in women for immoral purposes was another evil that followed the opening of the mines. The awful condition of the First Nations women in the streets and lanes of Victoria finally led to an effort on the part of some Christians for their rescue. And so it was in 1870 that a Sunday school was commenced on the Songhees side of the gorge in Victoria. And there were about 25 people who attended, and they needed to speak to some of these people in the Chinook language. And by that means, they reached the raw First Nations people who had very little English, had very little understanding of these things, and in God's grace, they saw some converts. The first convert was Amos Shiatson. Then his wife and a number of their friends were converted. And the first outward evidence of their conversion was that they left their manner of living in these longhouses and they built their own little houses because they wanted to establish Christian homes. That was the immediate impact of the gospel upon these people. They not only wanted to hear good news for their souls, but they realized they needed to live right and live differently for God and thus become a witness to their own people. Now that Sunday school, because of some difficulty getting across the river and charges and costs, they decided to open a Sunday school in the city side of Victoria on Fiskard and Government, right on the corner, and it was an old bar. And they turned it into a Sunday school house, a mission house, and they brought the same people over and others joined in. The Reverend William Pollard, who was the superintendent of the Methodist mission in the province, wrote regarding this work, and I'm giving you the date for a good purpose, in December 1871. We've had a gracious revival among the First Nations. William McKay, Mrs. Use, and some others commenced a Sabbath school about a year ago. And Brother Crosby and David Solaston commenced preaching and holding prayer meetings every night. On October 30th, a meeting was held which resulted in 19 experiencing religion. That's how they put it. In June 1873, Mr. Pollard wrote, Mr. Crosby, who was in charge of the Indian mission at Nanaimo, visited Victoria during the March district meeting. Revival services resulted in the conversion of 40 or 50 First Nations, some from Fort Simpson, Alaska, the Queen Charlotte Islands, the Nass, Bella Bella, and other places along the north coast. That introduces you to the means, teaching Sunday school, sometimes in the Chinook and the native languages, the power of the first converts to attract others in to hear the gospel, and the dramatic change in their lives. Then there was another convert. She was a chieftainess, and I have great difficulty in how to pronounce her name. I'll spell it for you. D-I-E-X. Anyone here by that name? Well, that is the name of this remarkable young woman. She was the daughter of a First Nations chief. She grew up being prepared for the role of what we might call in their circle royal service, a very sheltered life. She could not go out unless she was attended by servants or slaves. And being raised for that role, she was courtly, she was proper, but very innocent of the world around her. One day at Fort Simpson, there arrived from the sea canoes, and one was loaded with blankets. This young chieftain S, the chief's daughter, asked her helpers, "What does this mean?" And they told her, "These blankets are an arrangement that the chief of this nation, of the people that are coming by sea, his wife died, and you are to be married to him." Well, in her own words later, she referred to him as a decrepit old man. And she would have none of it, and so she ran away from her home. And she ran to the fort, where she was sheltered for a time. And she had some kind of an alliance with a Frenchman. They had a child together. And later she ended up in Victoria, married to a man called Lawson. She was on the streets of Victoria and walking past this mission on Fiskard and government. She heard the singing and she looked in, saw a little girl who invited her in. And that was the first time that she personally met Christians and heard the gospel. Now, in that meeting, and in successive meetings, she heard Amos Shiatson, the very first convert. And he was praying, leading in prayer in Chinook. And she knew every word. She could understand what he was praying. And she was drawn by the Spirit of God right into that meeting. The next Wednesday, the missionaries held a prayer meeting in her home. There were about 50 people who attended, and there were converts. And Diex, however it's pronounced, was one of those converts. Being a chieftain's daughter, having the heritage that she had, she was a woman of great influence. Her first burden was for her son, who was born to the man, the Frenchman Dudeward. Alfred was his name. And she began to pray earnestly that God would bring her son into town to Victoria, that she may tell him the good news of her conversion. After much prayer and time, Alfred Dudeward arrived by canoe with a number of friends, his wife and son, and they arrived in Victoria, not for the gospel, but for whiskey. That was their intent. But Dew took the opportunity to tell the good news to her son, who listened to her but said he wanted none of it. Nevertheless, he and his wife were convinced to come along to one of the services, and his wife was converted. And later he was coerced to return to a meeting. And by the end of the meeting, he was on the floor on his knees, crying out for mercy. And instead of taking whiskey back to Fort Simpson, they took with them the gospel. And when they arrived back on the shores of Fort Simpson, they literally burst out into song. And as best they knew how, preached the gospel to the people at Fort Simpson, the Shimseans, their own people. And out of that interest and hunger grew the cry for a missionary, a preacher, a church to be established that the gospel might be preached. In July 1873, there was a camp held in Chilliwack. And at that camp, the Reverend Bryant was then the pastor, and Alfred Dudeward attended. That's the son of this chieftainess. And he was so mightily blessed at those meetings in Chilliwack that he was all fired up to preach the gospel. In August, they had a wonderful series of meetings in Victoria. And the Spirit of God was graciously poured out upon not just first-time converts, but new believers, people who had been saved for some time. The Spirit of God came down and did a work of grace in their hearts. I'm sure the Wesleyans said it was a second blessing. I'm sure they had a name for it. But they were not only now new converts, but they were willing to be missionaries themselves. And so by September, many of the northern people returned home, and I told you already how they introduced the message of the gospel. About that time, Thomas Crosby, who had been 12 years now in British Columbia, took his first furlough home to Ontario. And he spent a considerable time visiting churches in Ontario and Quebec to raise prayer interest and funds for the work here in the coast of British Columbia. But then also he met his wife, called Emma, who was a minister's daughter, and proposing marriage, he more or less said, "Are you willing to serve God at any cost?" And the answer was obvious. She became his wife. And they too arrived in Fort Simpson to commence the work under the name of the Methodist Mission. And it was soon after that that God sent a gracious revival among the Simpsons at Fort Simpson. Now, their first effort was to build a church. They realized this was very important to the local people, that this would give identity, it would give shelter, it would give great opportunity. And so they set about and they built an edifice that would house 1,000 people. You talk about vision? You talk about an undertaking? Now, they had some funds and they had lumber brought in from Victoria, but they also insisted that the local people do the work. Because you know how it is? When you pay and labor, it's your church. Someone else pays, it'll never be your church. You'll think it's somebody else's church. And so Reverend Crosby was very wise in involving the local people in raising this church building. All the while, he was learning the ways of the Simpsons and their beliefs. They had a vague conception about a supreme deity, known to them as the Great Chief Above. However, in practice, they worshipped objects. They worshipped rocks, trees, fish. They worshipped mountain birds, and even the waves of the sea. Because you know how people say the waves talk and the thunder. These are the things that the First Nations people actually pray to and gave their devotion to. As I mentioned, they had no written text, no Bible, no written code of right and wrong. Everything was orally communicated. And of course, their legends. Well, pure mythology. When you read some of the things, and I'll give you one of them later, what they actually held as factual would just out of all question. They no doubt had a religion of fear. They feared thunder. They feared before going hunting and fishing, they would go and they would go through a whole ritual where they would, some people call it emitting. It is just emptying your stomach contents. It is bathing and praying and all of these things. They had a belief on the origin of light. They had a long story of a woven basket and the great chief's daughter who became the mother of a child. And that was the creation of light. Then on the origin of man, the Nazgûs, who lived close by, believed that man was originally the production of a mountain fish. The rocks were agitating the question of giving origin to man, but in the meantime, he was produced by the mountain fish. And they say, this is their account, that it is because man comes from a fish that he is mortal. If he had come from the rocks, he would be immortal. That is the kind of thinking and concepts that these First Nations people had. Then their view on death, the Nazca philosophy of death. I'm not sure where the Nazca fit in. They were somewhere in the communities. As I mentioned, many of these tribes and peoples, they lived at the mouths of rivers, on deltas with mountains in the background, or on islands. Sometimes people of a particular island would have their own heritage and name. But as to death, the Nazca people believed that the ancient tradition was that after death there were two roads open to the departed, one to the right and the other to the left. The road to the right was red, smooth and ever growing more beautiful all along, while that to the left was dark, rough and ever growing worse the farther one traveled along it. Those traveling the red road had abundance of fish to eat and water to drink, while those on the dark road had neither. The red road led to the habitation of robins. Robins were therefore supposed to be enchanted and possessed of supernatural power. Now, I'm taking time to look into some of these things because we live in a day when missionaries or churches and missions are being asked to make apologies for evangelizing the First Nations people to draw them away from their beliefs, their culture, to live a new life. But you can understand that when Thomas Crosby and the other missionaries learned of these strange, pathetic legends and beliefs, that they needed the gospel. They needed the gospel. I went out for a walk last night, and I mulled over in my mind, is it right that we would call a First Nation person today to leave their superstitious beliefs, their legends, their myths, their culture, and live a New Testament Bible Christian life? Is that right? I came up with these little points. It's right because they have no definition of God. They really have no definition of God. They have no Bible. Therefore, they do not know right from wrong. They have no Savior, no way of mercy. They have no hope. And if we do not evangelize First Nations people, their blood is on our hands. If we do not witness the gospel, Paul said that if our gospel is hid, it is hid to them that are lost. Woe unto us if we preach not the gospel. Now, we're living in delicate times when modernists and the humanist is saying, leave them alone. They have just as much right to their beliefs and their ways as Christians or Western civilization. But we are compelled to go forth with the message of the gospel. I want to tell you about a number of converts that were brought to Christ in Fort Simpson and among the Tsimshian people. Thomas Crosby reported that when he and other missionaries were gone out on a mission trip about 150 miles to visit another village, a revival broke out. And upon their return, the news came from the people, Jesus has come! Jesus has come! And his wife told, gave him the report after he came on shore, that on a particular night, they had seen that the whole town was awakened and they wanted into the church. And she told them to go home and just get back to normal life, but said, no, we need into the church because we must find Jesus. And it seems that the Spirit of God came down and moved mightily upon the hearts of the people. And I see, it seems strange that when the missionary was out of town, that the Spirit of God descended mightily upon these people and they were converted. Now, after the revival, after that move of God, there was a tremendous interest in the Bible. And they had what they called skulum text. And that means that after the service, people would gather to memorize the text of the sermon they just heard. The preacher would preach, and they would learn the text. And this now became a little club, a little special interest. And many people were memorizing the texts. There was a lady called Wee Nalik, and her baptized name became Old Susan. She was a Tsimshian who must have been around 60 years of age when she was converted. And she and a number of her children were also converted. And she gave herself to memorizing Bible texts. Now, these are people that never learned to write, had no schooling. And what she would do, she would take a little pebble, and for every Bible text that she memorized, she would associate it with a particular pebble, and she would have a pouch with all these little pebbles. And she would come to Reverend Crosby and say, "May I say my text to you today?" And it would take her a long time to go through all these pebbles and say each one of those texts. Well, later at her death, a missionary said to her, "Well, Susan, you are very sick and suffering very much today." "Oh, yes," she said, "but when I feel so sick, that text of God's word comes with such comfort." And repeating the text, she would say, "Oh, these good words make me so happy and seem to take away my pain." Many others did the same. There was a man that was baptized. His baptized name was Enoch. His First Nations name was Halobi, and he was a native of the Tsimshian nation. He was an early convert to Christ, but he suffered terribly with rheumatism, as many did. In the long, wet, cold winters without proper heating, rheumatism was a very big problem. When Enoch could not get out to the meetings, his wife would bring back the text that he should memorize. And when he came, his wife died. He went through a number of trials, and his wife died. And he joined this skulum text, and it said that he learned 60 separate verses. And he would go out and help at the meetings, that others also might learn God's word. Enoch was not perfectly sanctified, and someone gave him a stove. This was a mighty novelty. Could you imagine living in that culture and getting a metal stove where you can heat your home? They wouldn't have been living in the longhouse at that time. They would have had their own little home. But to receive a metal stove and get the fire going would be a great excitement. Well, old Enoch, when he was fitting the pipes of the stove together, he got so frustrated, he got so angry, that he took an axe and he smashed the whole thing to pieces. And his poor wife was sitting there with her head in her hands, and they called for the minister to come. And Enoch was heartbroken in what he had done, and he asked for mercy, and he pleaded forgiveness. And this was the sanctifying process that many of these people went through. The converts of the Tsimshian people who became Christians learned to keep the Sabbath day. They had at the church, which was visible from the shore, a flagpole, and every Lord's Day they raised the flag so that the Christians and others and traders would know that it was the Lord's Day. Now, the First Nations converts to Christianity at Fort Simpson, they also learned not to go fishing and hunting on the Lord's Day. It was God's Day. and they would spend it, the most of it, in God's house. And even when canneries opened and miners offered them profit and money to work, they would not be tempted to go and work in those places. Indeed, some of the young men proved that they could do more in 6 days than other workers could do in 7. And it just shows you the power of the gospel at work in the lives of these first generation Christians, transformed. Many limitations. You know, how would you teach them the doctrine of justification? How would you teach them the concepts and the great principles of the gospel? Much of it was just book, chapter, and verse. That was their knowledge. But the Spirit of God took that and applied it to their hearts with great power. There's a number of stories of those who defied the flag flying on the Sabbath day, and they took their boats out and they were needed to be rescued at sea and so on. And that confirmed all the more to the believers that God was blessing them for honoring him on the Sabbath. I want to close with a typical day at church for the Tsimshian Christians who were new believers. 6 a.m., an early morning prayer meeting, attendance about 60 people. 10 a.m., a teacher's class. 10:30, the ringing of the bell to call the people to worship. When the bell stopped, the doors were closed, and very seldom was anyone late. We could learn from that. 11 a.m., the minister ascended to the pulpit. They had their morning service, and at 2:30, they had a Sabbath school. At 4 p.m., they went out to visit and to preach in the open air. At 6:30 p.m., there was a preaching service with a testimony meeting to close the day. They had no time to go fishing, no time for hunting. They had a whole day in God's house. And what a power the gospel was in the lives of these people. And just as we learned here in Thessalonians chapter 1, how they turn from idols to serve the living God. And that was repeated at Fort Simpson and in much of the ministry of Reverend Thomas Crosby. So let us tonight not despair for the future of Christ's church. If God can save people who were raw from the darkness and the ignorance with no gospel, no language in which to communicate it, surely God is able to build his church in our generation. But we need missionaries. We need men, women, and young people with that passion in their souls. We must go with the gospel. And it is that passion that we greatly need. As I have researched some of this, I've been amazed at in those primitive, well, primitive compared to the complex society we live in with internet and electricity and aeroplanes and shipping and cars. There was none of these things, but they had men. They had men who would preach the gospel. And today we have modern churches with all of these luxuries, but where are the men and the women who will say, I will go, counting not the cost? And it will not be without much prayer. What I have learned, especially that beginning in the Songhees in Victoria, that first Sunday school, it was started as many great adventures for Christ by prayer. And we need to begin to pray that God will revive his church and send revival. My closest introduction to the ways of Native people was in Prince George a few years ago when I visited the university. I noticed the day following they were having a convention of elders, and there were 2,000 elders, First Nations people, having a convention the next day. So I took, I think it was Aaron Fitzsimons, I took him the next day and we went into the meeting. And I wanted to hear what they had to say. I wanted to hear what this was all about and meet these people. And I heard from the platform this story of a woman who in her youth, she was awakened in the morning by her mother, and the mother was saying, get up, your brother is calling you. And it was the call of the coyotes in the distance, your brothers. The First Nations people who are being encouraged to go back to their oral traditions are lost without Christ. That same day, I met a lady who was a Christian, a native. She was from Port Hardy area, right on the north tip of Vancouver Island. And I asked her, how did you hear the gospel? And she said, my grandmother told me about Jesus. There was a generation amongst those people that knew the gospel. These churches amongst these people, well, they turned into the United Church in 1925, but those churches no longer preach the gospel. This is a tragedy, and we ought to have a renewed and fresh burden that the Lord will do a new thing among these people to call them to faith in Jesus. Will you pray for that? Will you come on Wednesday night and join us in prayer for that? That's what church prayer meetings are about, praying for the lost. I pray that God may call someone here tonight to be a missionary, a witness to the lost, however he may lead you.